90.3 FM, Montreal.
The radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is Wednesday, the 8th of September, and I'm your host, Stefan Christoph. Free City Radio broadcasts every week at 11 o'clock a.m. on Wednesdays. Thanks for tuning in. Today on the broadcast, I'm going to be featuring a conversation I had with a community organizer based in Minnesota, Jelani Hussein, who works with the Council on American Islamic Relations, Minnesota. Jelani has been really involved in drawing attention to systemic police violence and systemic racism targeting Black communities in Minnesota. Jelani was one of the organizers of one of the very first protests in response to the police killing of George Floyd last year. Jelani and others from the Council on American Islamic Relations and many other community groups took the streets right after George Floyd was murdered. And I thought it would be important to call Jelani now, summer 2021, and see how the organizing efforts are going. The Council on American Islamic Relations really is an organization, I feel like, in interesting ways, balances between street-level action, but also pushes for representation in the efforts to push for anti-racist legislation. Council on American Islamic Relations also has a chapter in Canada, and it has been an organization that has spoken out against systemic racism, anti-Black racism, and Islamophobia. So I had the chance to speak with Jelani about the organizing that's been happening on the streets of Minneapolis, but more broadly, the efforts of the Council on American Islamic Relations, and to talk about what Black Lives Matter means. Of course, Minnesota is a state where the Somali diaspora is very strongly represented. Congresswoman Ilhan Omar is representing a district in Minnesota. So Jelani and others, I think, have been doing such amazing work to draw links between different experiences of systemic racism and different movements fighting together for justice, including the Black Lives Matter movement. So here's my conversation with Jelani Hussein. This is Free City Radio on CKUT 90.3 FM. It is the 8th of September, and I broadcast every Wednesday at 11 o'clock. So here's my conversation with Jelani. I'm joined by Jelani Hussein, who is the director of the Council on American Islamic Relations in Minnesota. I was able to speak with Jelani about a year ago, right after the police murder of George Floyd. CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations, was one of the organizers of the first protests in the Twin Cities. So it's great to see you just a little bit more than a year later, Jelani. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks. So it's been, actually much more than a year now since the police murder of George Floyd. I found it so moving and important that CARE stepped up in that time. I'm familiar with CARE's work here in Canada in struggling against systemic racism and Islamophobia on various fronts, and they've done such important work. But in Minneapolis, CARE was on the streets. Looking back at this year, there must be so much to reflect on, but how has the mobilization been? And do you feel like that street mobilization played an important role in shaping the public conversation around George Floyd's murder? And I'm asking that because I think maybe often, at least in the mainstream discourse, the importance of street mobilization and community presence on the streets isn't sort of understood as a key part of the political process.
No, I think that's a good point. First of all, thank you for having me. And you know, I it's been a year plus now, and I think that year seems like such a long time ago because of everything that happened. And what I think George Floyd incident did, it opened the eyes of so many people locally and abroad to police murders. You know, I don't think that we have been silent or unaware of state violence by police, you know, like never before. I mean, people are showing up to scenes. People are pulling their phones up just at a random police action. More and more white people are starting to believe black people around police violence and police brutality. We're starting to see investigations to previous cases that have long been ignored. We are seeing that this is not an isolated incident. So right as George Floyd's trial is going on here in Minnesota, you know, nearly a few miles away, a young man named Dante Wright was killed by a white officer who apparently mistaken her taser for her gun, or mistaken the gun for her taser. And so we know that unarmed black men are treated differently, more hostile, and more likely to die in police encounters. It's also interesting that during this time when George Floyd was killed, we did see, right around Dante Wright was also killed, we saw a man, a white man, who not only threatened cops, but actually literally was harming them with a hammer, was able to be apprehended. And here's a teenager who's driving a car with air fresheners dangling from his rear view that was stopped, pulled over, and then ends up being killed because the officer wanted to, you know, were so afraid that she wanted to pull her taser within seconds of just interacting with him. And even right after George Floyd was killed, not even 6 months, a Somali young man was killed named Dalal Eid. In fact, this case just became a bit more movement on that because the prosecutor who took the case is not going to charge the officers and it's not showing the family the videos. And there's a little bit of an uproar on that and hoping to see some change around that. So it's been, I would say fundamentally the biggest change that I've noticed is society in general has changed. Whether it's a temporary change, whether it's a permanent change, time will tell. I know in the Black community, you know, it was trauma compounded by trauma, compounded by more trauma, you know, and there is a reversal to some extent of what's been happening where police are ignoring and continuing to do what they have done, actually, which is not solve crimes within the Black community. We have Minnesota right now, as well in the rest of the country, an increased crime rate, which is, I personally believe, a direct result of the failure of the police. But they're using that as a way to, they're spinning that narrative as a narrative of, no, it's the uprising that is causing, it's the lower police count that's causing us not to respond. But it's actually a direct punishment to the Black communities across this country who have been vocal and the most vocal and the most appropriate to talk about these topics. And we're also noticing that when crimes do happen in neighborhoods or the victims are white, and it's, you know, we're seeing immediate results in finding and apprehending those individuals. But if you are in the Black neighborhood and you get shot or killed or something happens there, the likelihood of your case being set, you know, solved is very unlikely. So they're dragging their feet intentionally to suffocate the community and force this idea that the only way to be safe is to have more police. Well, we know the statistics and the data that prior to the killing of George Floyd, crime rates were going up. Prior to the killing of George Floyd, Black neighborhoods and Black crime were not solved, you know, but now the public relations I would call the public relations machine of the police departments, wherever they are in the United States, across in Canada. They are trying to win back people by literally scaring them, and also sharing, you know, the police officer who gives the ice cream story, you know, to a kid story. So they're doing both, and they're trying to, and even I've noticed it here in Minnesota, where, you know, a crime happens and there's like 9 press conferences about it, where previously one would do it, or maybe nothing. It would just be a blimp on the news. But now they're grandstanding on every single crime, as if like, oh, the city has been lost to crime. You know, I lived in Minnesota in the early 90s, and in 1995 and 96, those era, you know, there was 187 murders in the city. You know, 187. Now we're slated to have maybe a little under 70 or 60 based on the current trend, you know, and that would be still high, because I think last year was about 60 or 62 or whatever. But, you know, they're using it like, oh my God, we've the threshold is so high. So that narrative spin is in play now. Unfortunately, also what we did notice, and we have noticed, is that Democrats in this country who self-align with the Black community and this issue of the killing of George Floyd have failed to really pass any meaningful legislation, whether on the federal level or at the state level here in Minnesota, and even the city level. We know that, you know, the George Floyd Act, which is a federal act, has been stalled and has not been passed. In fact, we've had all these measures passed for other communities, for the Asian community after the hate incidents. You know, there was policies rushed through to help and address that, which is rightfully so. But at the same time, here's an issue that's been sitting, and in fact, President Biden, of all people, has been one in person who should be righting the wrong that he has caused the Black community in the era of tough on crime that he led. And here he can't. And it's, what's the excuse? The Republicans, they control all 3 houses of 3 branches of the United States government. And then in the state of Minnesota, the state that killed George Floyd, we passed more policing bills than anything else. We could not pass a single police accountability bills. And Democrats caved and allowed Republicans to pass tougher police bills. In fact, you know, the state that killed George Floyd did not have George Floyd's family honored at the Capitol when the session was going on. Instead, a police officer who was, you know, unfortunately injured at the line of duty was allowed to be out of decorum and out of process on the floor of the Senate by the Republicans, while families who were, you know, their loved ones being killed by police did not get those honoring, did not get those recognition. And so, and Minnesota is a very considered to be a liberal state, but when it comes to policing, it's not liberal. And I think for many people, the slow progress to political change has to be a realization and awakening to the history of these political parties. Both the Democrats and Republicans in the 90s were out-dueling each other. Who can be more supportive of policing? The Joe Bidens of the world were talking about how they need tough on crime. And in that race, actually, Republicans lost. It was Democrats who were the most aligned with policing because they favored unionization and support for unions in policing. And that offered more pay, more support. And then when it came to funding law enforcement, you know, Republicans love small governments, so they don't want to give all this money to departments, right? And police departments eat a huge share of line of funding. But sadly, you know, Democrats were the ones that were loved by police because they funded them more. They protected their pension and they created them loopholes and everything. And Republicans now are carrying that mantle, even though Democrats can't unhinge, as they've had long history of relationship with these people and they have long supported them. And so when George Floyd was killed and that the world demanded change, the slowest to progress has been politics and policies, which is the most effective way to really fundamentally change. However, what fundamentally changes the society, the people around, And also even just the industries, from corporations to Hollywood to you name it, all of those groups have started to create, you know, black content, which is because it's now sellable. It's a thing now. It's in the back of the ingrained in the conscience of many people. George Floyd is a synonymous for police violence, and who will never be forgotten, nor this incident. And through this terrible tragedy, more people hopefully will be saved, and America will be better for it, and the rest of the world around not silencing state violence that particularly is occurring on the streets in Minneapolis and across this country.
Thank you, Jelani. You bring up like a really important issue that I think is really, it's multi-layered and it's often like difficult to articulate in terms of like the hype politics of the news cycle, which is, you know, CAIR, the Council on American Islamic Relations, has played a role in pushing legislation, not just in the US, but also in Canada, or challenging specific laws and going through the legal processes to basically try to unravel the various manifestations of systemic racism in relation to policing, but also more generally in relation to, you know, government legislation that criminalizes racialized communities, particularly Muslim communities. But thinking about that and everything you just talked about regarding the Democratic Party in the United States, I think it's not, you know, only in the US. We see sort of a similar pattern with the Liberal Party in Canada. But there is that process, you know, and I know that you have been both on the streets, but also trying to deal with that type of political process, which, you know, isn't always sexy, you know, it isn't always hype. It's also involves behind the scenes work and negotiating with people that you might not be 100% on board with on a variety of things. Obviously, the street protest has created a lot of space for, you know, your organization, the Council on American Islamic Relations in Minnesota, but many other groups to actually have more space in that sort of process. But I think that often, you know, with all the hashtags and, you know, the very important work that, you know, Gen Z is doing online to address these issues, it's sometimes, yeah, I just was wondering if you could comment on the importance of that sort of like institutional push that is not really covered, and there isn't really a clear way to cover it, if you see what I'm saying.
No, absolutely. I think there's two big processes, and both are equally important and they're equally connected. And the first one is the one that everybody sees, which is the protest, right? People in the streets, you know, and this is known. We've known that, you know, in all history that early response and reaction is high by populace. People will show up at the beginning of the fight. And as the fight continues on, less and less people will show up. But the concept of showing up is critically important. It's perhaps the, you know, the reasoning for the change, the reasoning that right now Derek Chauvin is charged the way he was charged. It was because people actually showed up and protested and demanded that. And it created an entire security apparatus to deal with the state of Minnesota protesting. We had an entire operation called Operation Safety Net, which, you know, we saw it manifest and play out aggressively against protesters right after Dante Wright was killed, while George Floyd's trial was going on. And so protesting and public action and continuous public action by people, no matter where they are, no matter how small it is, no matter how large it is extremely impactful. I will share the example of, you know, and I know she has a lot of privilege, but Greta from Europe there, and you know, her coming on the scene was a simple one-person protest at the most important area, and she got few media, and there was a liking to her, and she had the right, you know, maybe image or something, but she played the right play, which is protesting. Consistent and aggressive protesting can have an impact and a long-term impact. It will move other people as well.
The point of the consistency issue. Yeah.
Absolutely. But at the same time, you cannot protest aimlessly. You have to have a purposeful protest. And this is something we've learned in history, especially in Dr. King and the civil rights movement. They did not protest because they just wanted to protest. They protested with a purpose that would move the needle forward. So we protested here to demand justice, not only inside a courthouse, but also outside the courthouse. We demanded justice to change policies. And we protested also in front of political leaders' homes, because in COVID, everybody was hiding behind Zoom. You know, they're hiding behind, they would not interact with the community. They would not answer questions. And so we went to their front lines, and that was seen as controversial, but they chose to be political officers. We didn't ask them to, right? They could have had a private life if they wanted to. Nobody goes into somebody's home if you're a private, right? You're political, you chose the job, you're supposed to be accessible to the entire constituents, and we're gonna show up to your front door. And that is seen as radical, you know, seen as something crazy. But the reality is that this is part of the protests and putting pressure, and we faced a great deal of opposition, whether we did it in the Twin Cities, in the urban center, but also in rural areas where we were faced with armed militia who were there to threaten us, to intimidate us from protesting in front of rural candidates who usually are very conservative and racist at times toward the Black community and even to the urban centers issues. Even though their entire tax base is supported by the urban centers, you know, we pay for their electricity and we pay for their roads being paved, we pay for their water, and we pay for their police officers and fire. They cannot sustain their financially cannot sustain their own government. They rely on local aid. And so those two points you mentioned are critically important, that you protest, but you also try to negotiate policies. You want to use that pressure that you're building with the community.
That was a conversation with Shalani Hussain from the Council on American Islamic Relations in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, an organization that has been very active in supporting the Black Lives Matter movement, an organization that was one of the community groups, institutions that organized the first protests in response to the police murder of George Floyd. I thought it would be important to speak with Shalani, you know, summer 2021, about what the movement has been like as a community activist for Shalani, his experiences and also his perspectives, having sustained involvement for so long in this struggle. So thank you to Shalani for joining Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christoph. Free City Radio broadcasts every Wednesday at 11 o'clock on CKUT 90.3 FM, 11 a.m., of course, as you're hearing. And I like the fact that this show shares a radio hour with the F-Files, which is coming up next, so stay tuned for that. And to go out on the show today, I'm going to play a piece of music from Gaika. I'll talk to you next week. Thanks and take care.
Oh, stand by to watch and to see what took place and to join in this. We ask you for your special blessings upon everyone. And now, Father, we give it all to you. We pray, God, for special dedication. We pray for special blessing. Nothing shall vandalize this tomb, oh God. It shall be protected and preserved by your mighty hand, oh God. Let nothing comes around to disturb the dead that lies here.
Thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview. Could you just say hi to us for a moment? Just introduce yourself a little bit to us.
So my name's Rosa Farber. I'm from the southeast of England, from an organic vegetable farm. But I'm a performance artist and studied in London and Glasgow. And now I'm currently based in Glasgow. Yeah, that's it really.
You're from an organic vegetable farm, so that's where you grew up.
Yeah, it's my mum's farm, and she still farms there. And I probably will go back there and, you know, run projects and stuff like that in the future. But I'm still kind of biding some time up here in Scotland.